At first, the truths Phaedrus began to pursue were lateral truths. No longer the frontal truths of science, those toward which the discipline pointed, but the kind of truth you see laterally, out of the corner of your eye. In a laboratory situation, when your whole procedure goes haywire, when everything goes wrong or is indeterminate, or is so screwed up by unexpected results you can't make head or tail out of anything, you start looking laterally. That's a word he later used to describe a growth of knowledge that doesn't move forward like an arrow in flight, but expands sideways, like an arrow enlarging in flight. Or like the archer discovering that although he has hit the bullseye and won the prize, his head is on a pillow and the sun is coming in the window. Lateral knowledge is knowledge that's from a wholly unexpected direction, from a direction that's not even understood as a direction until the knowledge forces itself upon one. Lateral truths point to the falseness of axioms and postulates underlying one's existing system of getting at truth. To all appearances, he was just drifting. In actuality, he was just drifting. Drifting is what one does when looking at lateral truth. He couldn't follow any known method of procedure to uncover its cause because it was these methods and procedures that were all screwed up in the first place. So he drifted. That was all he could do. The drift took him into the army, which sent him to Korea. From his memory there's a fragment, a picture of a wall seen from a prow of a ship, shining radiantly, like a gate of heaven, across a misty harbor. He must have valued the fragment greatly and thought about it many times because, although it doesn't fit anything else, it is intense. So intense, I've returned to it myself many times. It seems to symbolize something very important, a turning point. His letters from Korea are radically different from his earlier writing, indicating this same turning point. They just explode with emotion. He writes page after page about tiny details of things he sees. Marketplaces, shops with sliding glass doors, slate roofs, roads, thatched huts, everything. Sometimes full of wild enthusiasm, sometimes depressed, sometimes angry, sometimes even humorous. He is like someone or some creature that has found an exit from a cage he did not even know was around him and is wildly roaming over the countryside, visually devouring everything in sight. Later he made friends with Korean laborers who spoke some English but wanted to learn more so that they could qualify as translators. He spent time with them after working hours, and in return they took him on long weekend hikes through the hills to see their homes and friends, and translate for him the way of life and thought of another culture. He is sitting by a footpath on a beautiful, windswept hillside overlooking the Yellow Sea. The rice in the terrace below the footpath is full-grown and brown. His friends look down at the sea with him, seeing islands far out from shore. They eat a picnic lunch and talk to one another and to him, and the subject is ideographs and their relation to the world. He comments on how amazing it is that everything in the universe can be described by the 26 written characters with which they have been working. His friends nod and smile and eat the food they've taken from tins and say no pleasantly. He is confused by the nod yes and the answer no, and so repeats the statement. Again comes the nod meaning yes and the answer no. That is the end of the fragment. But like the wall, it's one he thinks about many times. The final strong fragment from that part of the world is of a compartment of a troop ship. He is on his way home. The compartment is empty and unused. He is alone on a bunk made of canvas laced to a steel frame, like a trampoline. There are five of these to a tier after tier of them, completely filling the empty troop compartment. This is the foremost compartment of the ship, and the canvas in the adjoining frames rises and falls, accompanied by elevator feelings in his stomach. He contemplates these things, and a deep booming on the steel plates all around him, and realizes that except for these signs, there is no indication whatsoever that this entire compartment is rising massively high up into the air and then plunging down over and over again. He wonders if it is that which is making it difficult to concentrate on the book before him. But realizes that no, the book is just hard. It's a text on Oriental philosophy, and it's the most difficult book he's ever read. He's glad to be alone and bored in this empty troop compartment. Otherwise, he'd never get through it. The book states that there's a theoretic component of man's existence, which is primarily Western, and this corresponded to Phaedrus's laboratory past, and an aesthetic component of man's existence, which is seen more strongly in the Orient, and this corresponded to Phaedrus's Korean past, and that these never seem to meet. These terms, theoretic and aesthetic, correspond to what Phaedrus later called classic and romantic modes of reality, and probably shaped these terms in his mind more than he ever knew. The difference is that the classic reality is primarily theoretic, but has its own aesthetics, too. The romantic reality is primarily aesthetic, but has its theory, too. The theoretic and aesthetic split is between components of a single world. The classic and romantic split is between two separate worlds. The philosophy book, which is called The Meeting of East and West by F.S.C. Northrop, suggests that greater cognizance be made of the undifferentiated aesthetic continuum from which the theoretic arises. Phaedrus didn't understand this, but after arriving in Seattle and his discharge from the army, he sat in his hotel room for 2 whole weeks, eating enormous Washington apples and thinking, and eating more apples and thinking some more, and then as a result of all these fragments and thinking, returned to the university to study philosophy. His lateral drift was ended. He was actively in pursuit of something now. A sudden cross gust of cold air comes heavy with the smell of pines, and soon another and another, and as we approach Red Lodge, I'm shivering. At Red Lodge, the roads almost join to the base of the mountain. The dark, ominous mass beyond dominates even the roofs of the buildings on either side of the main street. We park the cycles and unpack them to remove warm clothing. We walk past ski shops into a restaurant, where we see on the walls huge photographs of the route we will take up. And up and up, over one of the highest paved roads in the world. I feel some anxiety about this, which I realize is irrational, and try to get rid of by talking about the road to the others. There's no way to fall off. No danger to the motorcycle. Just a memory of places where you could throw a stone and it would drop thousands of feet before coming to rest, and somehow associating that stone with the cycle and rider. When coffee is finished, we put on the heavy clothing, repack, and have soon traveled to the first of many switchback turns across the face of the mountain. The asphalt of the road is much wider and safer than it occurred in memory. On a cycle, you have all sorts of extra room. John and Sylvia take the hairpin turns up ahead and then come back above us, facing us, and have smiles. Soon we take the turn and see their backs again. Then another turn for them, and we meet them again, laughing. It's so hard when contemplated in advance, and so easy when you do it. I talked about Phaedrus's lateral drift, which ended with entry into the discipline of philosophy. He saw philosophy as the highest echelon of the entire hierarchy of knowledge. Among philosophers, this is so widely believed it's almost a platitude. But for him, it's a revelation. He discovered that the science he'd once thought of as the whole world of knowledge is only a branch of philosophy which is far broader and far more general. The questions he had asked about infinite hypotheses hadn't been of interest to science because they weren't scientific questions. Science cannot study scientific method without getting into a bootstrap problem that destroys the validity of its answers. The questions he'd asked were at a higher level than science goes. And so Phaedrus found in philosophy a natural continuation of the question that brought him to science in the first place. What does it all mean? What's the purpose of all this? At a turnout on the road, we stop, take some record photographs to show we have been here, and then walk to a little path that takes us out to the edge of a cliff. A motorcycle on the road almost straight down beneath us could hardly be seen from up here. We bundle up more tightly against the cold and continue upward. The broad-leafed trees are all gone. Only small pines are left. Many of these have twisted and stunted shapes. Soon stunted pines disappear entirely, and we're in alpine meadows. There's not a tree anywhere. Only grass everywhere, filled with little pink and blue and white dots of intense color. Wildflowers everywhere. These and grasses and mosses and lichens are all that can live here now. We've reached the high country, above the timberline. I look over my shoulder for one last view of the gorge. Like looking down at the bottom of the ocean. People spend their entire lives at those lower altitudes without any awareness that this high country exists. The road turns inward, away from the gorge, and into snowfields. The engine backfires fiercely from lack of oxygen and threatens to stop, but never does. Soon we are between banks of old snow, the way snow looks in early spring after a thaw. Little streams of water run everywhere into mossy mud, and then below this into weak old grass, and then small wildflowers, the tiny pink and blue and yellow and white ones, which seem to pop out, sun-brilliant, from black shadows. Everywhere it's like this. Little pins of colored light shoot forth to me from a background of somber dark green and black. Dark sky now and cold, except where the sun hits. On the sun side, my arm and leg and jacket are hot, but the dark side, in deep shadows now, is very cold. The snowfields become heavy and show steep banks where snowplows have been. The banks become 4 feet high, then 6 feet, then 12 feet. We move through twin walls, almost a tunnel of snow. Then the tunnel opens onto dark sky again, and when we emerge, we see we're at the summit. Beyond is another country. Mountain lakes and pines and snowfields are below. Above and beyond them, as far as we can see, are farther mountain ranges covered with snow. The high country. We stop and park at a turnoff, where a number of tourists take pictures, and look around at the view and at one another. At the back of his cycle, John removes his camera from the saddlebag. From my own machine, I remove the toolkit and spread it out on the seat, then take the screwdriver, start the engine, and with the screwdriver adjust the carburetors until the idling sound changes from a really bad loping to just slightly bad. I'm surprised at how all the way up it backfired and sputtered and kicked and gave every indication it was going to quit, but never did. I didn't adjust them, out of curiosity to see what 11,000 feet of altitude would do. Now I'm leaving them rich and sounding just bad because we'll be going down some now, toward Yellowstone Park, and if they aren't slightly rich now, they'll get too lean later on, which is dangerous because it overheats the engine. The backfiring is still fairly heavy on the way down from the summit, with the engine dragging in second gear, but then the noise diminishes as we reach lower altitudes. The forests return. We move among rocks and lakes and trees now, taking beautiful turns and curves of the road. I want to talk about another kind of high country now in the world of thought, which in some ways, for me at least, seems to parallel or produce feelings similar to this, and call it the high country of the mind. If all of human knowledge, everything that's known, is believed to be an enormous hierarchic structure, then the high country of the mind is found at the uppermost reaches of this structure, in the most general, the most abstract considerations of all. Few people travel here. There's no real profit to be made from wandering through it. Yet, like this high country of the material world all around us, it has its own austere beauty that to some people make the hardships of traveling through it seem worthwhile. In the high country of the mind, one has to become adjusted to the thinner air of uncertainty and to the enormous magnitude of questions asked and to the answers proposed to these questions. The sweep goes on and on and on, so obviously much further than the mind can grasp. One hesitates even to go near for fear of getting lost in them and never finding one's way out. What is the truth, and how do you know it when you have it? How do we really know anything? Is there an I, a soul, which knows? Or is this soul merely cells coordinating senses? Is reality basically changing, or is it fixed and permanent? When it's said that something means something, what's meant by that? Many trails through these high ranges have been made and forgotten since the beginning of time, and although the answers brought back from these trails have claimed permanence and universality for themselves, civilizations have varied in the trails they have chosen, and we have many different answers to the same question, all of which can be thought of as true within their own context. Even within a single civilization, old trails are constantly closed and new ones opened up. It's sometimes argued that there's no real progress, that a civilization that kills multitudes in mass warfare, that pollutes the land and oceans with ever larger quantities of debris, that destroys the dignity of individuals by subjecting them to a forced, mechanized existence, can hardly be called an advance over the simpler hunting and gathering and agricultural existence of prehistoric times. But this argument, though romantically appealing, doesn't hold up. The primitive tribes permitted far less individual freedom than does modern society. Ancient wars were committed with far less moral justification than modern ones. A technology that produces debris can find, and is finding, ways of disposing of it without ecological upset. And the schoolbook pictures of primitive man sometimes omit some of the detractions of his primitive life. The pain, the disease, famine, the hard labor needed just to stay alive. From that agony of bare existence to modern life can be soberly described only as upward progress, and the sole agent for this progress is quite clearly reason itself. One can see how both the informal and formal processes of hypothesis, experiment, conclusion, century after century, repeated with new material, have built up the hierarchies of thought which have eliminated most of the enemies of primitive man. To some extent, the romantic condemnation of rationality stems from the very effectiveness of rationality in uplifting men from primitive conditions. It's such a powerful, all-dominating agent of civilized man, it's all but shut out everything else, and now dominates man himself. That's the source of the complaint. Phaedrus wandered through this high country, aimlessly at first, following every path, every trail where someone had been before, seeing occasionally with small hindsights that he was apparently making some progress, but seeing nothing ahead of him that told him which way to go. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig continued. Cassette 4, Side 1. Phaedrus wandered through this high country, aimlessly at first, following every path, every trail where someone had been before, seeing occasionally with small hindsights that he was apparently making some progress, but seeing nothing ahead of him that told him which way to go. Through the mountainous questions of reality and knowledge had passed great figures of civilization, some of whom, like Socrates and Aristotle and Newton and Einstein, were known to almost everyone, but most of whom were far more obscure, names he had never heard of before. And he became fascinated with their thought and their whole way of thinking. He followed their trails carefully until they seemed to grow cold, then dropped them. His work was just barely passing by academic standards at this time, but this wasn't because he wasn't working or thinking. He was thinking too hard. And the harder you think in this high country of the mind, the slower you go. Phaedrus read in a scientific way rather than a literary way, testing each sentence as he went along, noting doubts and questions to be resolved later. And I'm fortunate in having a whole trunkful of volumes of these notations. What is most astonishing about them is that almost everything he said years later is contained in them. It's frustrating to see how completely unaware he is at the time of the significance of what he is saying. It's like seeing someone handling one by one all the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, whose solution you know, and you want to tell him, "Look, this fits here, and this fits here." But you can't tell him. And so he wanders blindly along one trail after another, gathering one piece after another, and wondering what to do with them. And you grit your teeth when he goes off on a false trail, and are relieved when he comes back again, even though he has discouraged himself. "Don't worry," you want to tell him. "Keep going." But he's such an abominable scholar, it must be through the kindness of his instructors that he passes it all. He prejudges every philosopher he studies. He always intrudes and imposes his own views upon the material he is studying. He is never fair. He is always partial. He wants each philosopher to go a certain way and becomes infuriated when he does not. A fragment of memory is preserved of him, sitting in a room at 3 and 4 in the morning with Immanuel Kant's famous Critique of Pure Reason, studying it as a chess player studies the openings of the tournament masters, trying to test the line of development against his own judgment and skill, looking for contradictions and incongruities. Phaedrus is a bizarre person when contrasted to the 20th-century Midwestern Americans who surround him, but when he is seen studying Kant, he is less strange. For this 18th-century German philosopher, he feels a respect that rises not out of agreement, but out of appreciation for Kant's formidable logical fortification of his position. Kant is always superbly methodical, persistent, regular, and meticulous, as he scales that great snowy mountain of thought concerning what is in the mind and what is outside the mind. It is, for modern climbers, one of the highest peaks of all. And I want now to magnify this picture of Kant and show a little about how he thought, and how Phaedrus thought about him, in order to give a clearer picture of what the high country of the mind is like, and also to prepare for an understanding of Phaedrus's thoughts. Phaedrus's resolution of the entire problem of classic and romantic understanding occurred at first in this high country of the mind. And unless one understands the relation of this country to the rest of existence, the meaning and the importance of lower levels of what he said here will be underestimated or misunderstood. To follow Kant, one must also understand something about the Scottish philosopher David Hume. Hume had previously submitted that if one follows the strictest rules of logical induction and deduction from experience to determine the true nature of the world, one must arrive at certain conclusions. His reasoning followed lines that would result from answers to this question. Suppose a child is born devoid of all senses. He has no sight, no hearing, no touch, no smell, no taste, nothing. There's no way whatsoever for him to receive any sensations from the outside world. And suppose this child is fed intravenously, and otherwise attended to and kept alive for 18 years in this state of existence. The question is then asked, does this 18-year-old person have a thought in his head? If so, where does it come from? How does he get it? Hume would have answered that the 18-year-old had no thoughts whatsoever, and in giving this answer would have defined himself as an empiricist, one who believes all knowledge is derived exclusively from the senses. The scientific method of experimentation is carefully controlled empiricism. Common sense today is empiricism, since an overwhelming majority would agree with Hume, even though in other cultures and other times a majority might have differed. The first problem of empiricism, if empiricism is believed, concerns the nature of substance. If all our knowledge comes from sensory data, what exactly is this substance which is supposed to give off the sensory data itself? If you try to imagine what this substance is, apart from what is sensed, you'll find yourself thinking about nothing whatsoever. Since all knowledge comes from sensory impressions, and since there's no sensory impression of substance itself, it follows logically that there is no knowledge of substance. It's just something we imagine. It's entirely within our own minds. The idea that there's something out there giving off the properties we perceive is just another of those common sense notions, similar to the common sense notion children have, that the earth is flat and parallel lines never meet. Secondly, if one starts with the premise that all our knowledge comes to us through our senses, one must ask, from what sense data is our knowledge of causation received? In other words, what is the scientific, empirical basis of causation itself? Hume's answer is none. There's no evidence for causation in our sensations. Like substance, it's just something we imagine when one thing repeatedly follows another. It has no real existence in the world we observe. If one accepts the premise that all knowledge comes to us through our senses, Hume says, then one must logically conclude that both nature and nature's laws are creations of our own imagination. This idea, that the entire world is within one's own mind, could be dismissed as absurd if Hume had just thrown it out for speculation. But he was making it an airtight case. To throw out Hume's conclusions was necessary, but unfortunately he had arrived at them in such a way that it was seemingly impossible to throw them out without abandoning empirical reason itself and retiring into some medieval predecessor of empirical reason. This Kant would not do. Thus it was Hume, Kant said, who aroused me from my dogmatic slumbers and caused him to write what is now regarded as one of the greatest philosophical treatises ever written, The Critique of Pure Reason, often the subject of an entire university course. Kant is trying to save scientific empiricism from the consequences of its own self-devouring logic. He starts out at first along the path that Hume has set before him. That all our knowledge begins with experience, there can be no doubt, he says. But he soon departs from the path by denying that all components of knowledge come from the senses at the moment the sense data are received. But though all knowledge begins with experience, it doesn't follow that it arises out of experience. This seems at first as though he is picking nits, but he isn't. As a result of this difference, Kant skirts right around the abyss of solipsism that Hume's path leads to, and proceeds on an entirely new and different path of his own. Kant says there are aspects of reality which are not supplied immediately by the senses. These he calls a priori. An example of a priori knowledge is time. You don't see time. Neither do you hear it, smell it, taste it, or touch it. It isn't present in the sense data as they are received. Time is what Kant calls an intuition, which the mind must supply as it receives the sense data. The same is true of space. Unless we apply the concepts of space and time to the impressions we receive, the world is unintelligible, just a kaleidoscopic jumble of colors and patterns and noises and smells and pain and tastes without meaning. We sense objects in a certain way because of our application of a priori intuitions, such as space and time, but we do not create these objects out of our imagination, as pure philosophical idealists would maintain. The forms of space and time are applied to data as they are received from the object producing them. The a priori concepts have their origins in human nature so that they're neither caused by the sensed object nor bring it into being, but provide a kind of screening function for what sense data we will accept. When our eyes blink, for example, our sense data tell us that the world has disappeared. But this is screened out and never gets to our consciousness because we have in our minds an a priori concept that the world has continuity. What we think of as reality is a continuous synthesis of elements from a fixed hierarchy of a priori concepts and the ever-changing data of the senses. Now stop and apply some of the concepts Kant has put forth to this strange machine, this creation that's been bearing us along through time and space. See our relation to it now as Kant reveals it to us. Hume has been saying, in effect, that everything I know about this motorcycle comes to me through my senses. It has to be. There's no other way. If I say it's made of metal and other substances, he asks, what's metal? If I answer that metal's hard and shiny and cold to the touch and deforms without breaking under blows from a harder material, Hume says, those are all sights and sounds and touch. There's no substance. Tell me what metal is apart from these sensations. Then, of course, I'm stuck. But if there's no substance, what can we say about the sense data we receive? If I hold my head to the left and look down at the handle grips and front wheel and map carrier and gas tank, I get one pattern of sense data. If I move my head to the right, I get another slightly different pattern of sense data. The two views are different. The angles of the planes and curves of the metal are different. The sunlight strikes them differently. If there's no logical basis for substance, then there's no logical basis for concluding that what's produced these two views is the same motorcycle. Now we've a real intellectual impasse. Our reason, which is supposed to make things more intelligible, seems to be making them less intelligible. And when reason thus defeats its own purpose, something has to be changed in the structure of our reason itself. Kant comes to our rescue. He says that the fact that there's no way of immediately sensing a motorcycle, as distinguished from the colors and shapes a motorcycle produces, is no proof at all that there's no motorcycle there. We have in our minds an a priori motorcycle, which has continuity in time and space, and is capable of changing appearance as one moves one's head, and is therefore not contradicted by the sense data one is receiving. Hume's motorcycle, the one that makes no sense at all, will occur if our previous hypothetical bed patient, the one who has no senses at all, is suddenly, for 1 second only, exposed to the sense data of a motorcycle, then deprived of his senses again. Now, I think, in his mind, he would have a Hume motorcycle, which provides him with no evidence whatsoever for such concepts as causation. But as Kant says, we are not that person. We have in our minds a very real a priori motorcycle whose existence we have no reason to doubt, whose reality can be confirmed any time. This a priori motorcycle has been built up in our minds over many years from enormous amounts of sense data, and it is constantly changing as new sense data come in. Some of the changes in this specific a priori motorcycle I'm riding are very quick and transitory, such as its relationship to the road. This I'm monitoring and correcting all the time as we take these curves and bends in the road. As soon as the information's of no more value, I forget it because there's more coming in that must be monitored. Other changes in this a priori are slower. Disappearance of gasoline from the tank. Disappearance of rubber from the tires. Loosening of bolts and nuts. Change of gap between brake shoes and drums. Other aspects of the motorcycle change so slowly they seem permanent. The paint job, the wheel bearings, the control cables. Yet these are constantly changing too. Finally, if one thinks in terms of really large amounts of time, even the frame is changing slightly from the road shocks and thermal changes and forces of internal fatigue common to all metals. It's quite a machine, this a priori motorcycle. If you stop to think about it long enough, you'll see that it's the main thing. The sense data confirm it, but the sense data aren't it. The motorcycle that I believe in an a priori way to be outside of myself is like the money I believe I have in the bank. If I were to go down to the bank and ask to see my money, they would look at me a little peculiarly. They don't have my money in any little drawer that they can pull open to show me. My money is nothing but some east-west and north-south magnetic domains in some iron oxide, resting on a roll of tape in a computer storage bin. But I'm satisfied with this because I've faith that if I need the things that money enables, the bank will provide the means, through their checking system, of getting it. Similarly, even though my sense data have never brought up anything that could be called substance, I'm satisfied that there is a capability within the sense data of achieving the things that substance is supposed to do, and that the sense data will continue to match the a priori motorcycle of my mind. I say for the sake of convenience that I've money in the bank, and say for the sake of convenience that substances compose the cycle I'm riding on. The bulk of Kant's critique of pure reason is concerned with how this a priori knowledge is acquired, and how it is employed. Kant called his thesis that our a priori thoughts are independent of sense data and screen what we see a Copernican revolution. By this he referred to Copernicus's statement that the Earth moves around the Sun. Nothing changed as a result of this revolution, and yet everything changed. Or, to put it in Kantian terms, the objective world producing our sense data did not change, but our a priori concept of it was turned inside out. The effect was overwhelming. It was the acceptance of the Copernican revolution that distinguishes modern man from his medieval predecessors. What Copernicus did was take the existing a priori concept of the world, the notion that it was flat and fixed in space, and pose an alternative a priori concept of the world, that it's spherical and moves around the sun, and showed that both of the a priori concepts fitted the existing sensory data. Kant felt he had done the same thing in metaphysics. If you presume that the a priori concepts in our heads are independent of what we see and actually screen what we see, This means that you are taking the old Aristotelian concept of scientific man as a passive observer, a blank tablet, and truly turning this concept inside out. Kant and his millions of followers have maintained that as a result of this inversion, you get a much more satisfying understanding of how we know things. I've gone into this example in some detail, partly to show some of the high country in close perspective, but more to prepare for what Phaedrus did later. He too performed a Copernican inversion, and as a result of this inversion, produced a resolution of the separate worlds of classical and romantic understanding. And it seems to me that as a result, it is possible to again get a much more satisfying understanding of what the world is all about. Kant's metaphysics thrilled Phaedrus at first, but later it dragged, and he didn't know exactly why. He thought about it and decided that maybe it was the Oriental experience. He had had the feeling of escape from a prison of intellect, and now this was just more of the prison again. He read Kant's aesthetics with disappointment, and then anger. The ideas expressed about the beautiful were themselves ugly to him, and the ugliness was so deep and pervasive he hadn't a clue as to where to begin to attack it or try to get around it. It seemed woven right into the whole fabric of Kant's world so deeply, there was no escape from it. It wasn't just 18th-century ugliness or technical ugliness. All of the philosophers he was reading showed it. The whole university he was attending smelled of the same ugliness. It was everywhere, in the classroom, in the textbooks. It was in himself, and he didn't know how or why. It was reason itself that was ugly, and there seemed no way to get free. Chapter 12. At Cook City, John and Sylvia look and sound happier than I've seen them in years, and we whack into our hot beef sandwiches with great wax. I'm happy to hear and see all their high country exuberance, but don't comment much, just keep eating. Outside the picture window across the road are huge pines. Many cars pass beneath them on their way to the park. We're a long way down from the timberline now. Warmer here, but covered over with an occasional low cloud ready to drop rain. I suppose if I were a novelist rather than a Chautauqua orator, I'd try to develop the characters of John and Sylvia and Chris with action-packed scenes that would also reveal inner meanings of Zen, and maybe art, and maybe even motorcycle maintenance. That would be quite a novel, but for some reason I don't feel quite up to it. They're friends, not characters, and as Sylvia herself once said, I don't like being an object. So a lot of things we know about one another, I'm simply not going into. Nothing bad, but not really relevant to the Chautauqua. That's the way it should be with friends. At the same time, I think you can understand from the Chautauqua why I must always seem so reserved and remote to them. Once in a while, they ask questions that seem to call for a statement of what the hell I'm always thinking about. But if I were to babble what's really on my mind about, say, the a priori presumption of the continuity of a motorcycle from second to second, and do this without benefit of the entire edifice of the Chautauqua, they'd just be startled and wonder what's wrong. I really am interested in this continuity, and the way we talk and think about it, and so tend to get removed from the usual lunchtime situation, and this gives an appearance of remoteness. It's a problem. It's a problem of our time. The range of human knowledge today is so great that we're all specialists, and the distance between specializations has become so great that anyone who seeks to wander freely among them almost has to forgo closeness with the people around him. The lunchtime here and now stuff is a specialty, too. Chris seems to understand my remoteness better than they do, perhaps because he's more used to it, and his relationship to me is such that he has to be more concerned. In his face I sometimes see a look of worry, or at least anxiety, and wonder why, and then discover that I'm angry. If I hadn't seen his expression, I might not have known it. Other times he's running and jumping all over the place, and I wonder why, and discover that it's because I'm in a good mood. Now I see he's a little nervous, and answering a question that John had evidently directed at me. It's about the people we'll be staying with tomorrow, the Deweses. I'm not sure what the question was, but add, he's a painter. He teaches fine arts at the college there. an abstract impressionist. They ask how I came to know him, and I have to answer that I don't remember, which is a little evasive. I don't remember anything about him except fragments. He and his wife were evidently friends of Phaedrus's friends, and he came to know them that way. They wonder what an engineering writer like myself would have in common with an abstract painter, and I have to say again that I don't know. I mentally file through the fragments for an answer, but none comes. Their personalities were certainly different. Whereas photographs of Phaedrus's face during this period show alienation and aggression, a member of his department had half-jokingly called it a subversive look, some photographs of Deweese from the same period show a face that is quite passive, almost serene, except for a mild questioning expression. In my memory is a movie about a World War I spy who studied the behavior of a captured German officer, who looked exactly like him, by means of a one-way mirror. He studied him for months until he could imitate every gesture and nuance of speech. Then he pretended to be the escaped officer in order to infiltrate the German army command. I remember the tension and excitement as he faced his first test with the officer's old friends to learn if they would see through his imposture. Now I've some of the same feeling about Deweese, who'll naturally presume I'm the person he once knew. Outside, a light mist has made the motorcycles wet. I take out the plastic bubble from the saddlebag and attach it to the helmet. We'll be entering Yellowstone Park soon. The road ahead is foggy. It seems like a cloud has drifted into the valley, which isn't really a valley at all, but more of a mountain pass. I don't know how well Deweese knew him, and what memories he'll expect me to share. I've gone through this before with others, and have usually been able to gloss over awkward moments. The reward each time has been an expansion of knowledge about Phaedrus that has greatly aided further impersonation, and which, over the years, has supplied the bulk of the information I've been presenting here. From what fragments of memory I have, Phaedrus had a high regard for Deweese because he didn't understand him. For Phaedrus, failure to understand something created tremendous interest, and Deweese's attitudes were fascinating. They seemed all haywire. Phaedrus would say something he thought was pretty funny, and Deweese would look at him in a puzzled way, or else take him seriously. Other times, Phaedrus would say something that was very serious and of deep concern, and Deweese would break up laughing, as though he had cracked the cleverest joke he had ever heard. For example, there is a fragment of memory about a dining room table whose edge veneer had come loose, and which Phaedrus had re-glued. He held the veneer in place, while the glue set, by wrapping a whole ball of string around the table, round and round and round. Deweese saw the string and wondered what that was all about. "That's my latest sculpture," Phaedrus had said. "Don't you think it kind of builds?" Instead of laughing, Deweese looked at him with amazement, studied it for a long time, and finally said, "Where did you learn all this?" For a second, Phaedrus thought he was continuing the joke, but he was serious. Another time, Phaedrus was upset about some failing students. Walking home with Deweese under some trees, he had commented on it, and Deweese had wondered why he took it so personally. "I wondered, too," Phaedrus had said, and in a puzzled voice had added, "I think maybe it's because every teacher tends to grade up students who resemble him the most. If your own writing shows neat penmanship, you regard that more important in a student than if it doesn't. If you use big words, you're going to like students who write with big words." "Sure. What's wrong with that?" Deweese had said. "Well, there's something wacky here," Phaedrus had said, "because the students I like the most, the ones I really feel a sense of identity with, are all failing." Deweese had completely broken up with laughter at this, and left Phaedrus feeling miffed. He had seen it as a kind of scientific phenomenon that might offer clues leading to new understanding, and Deweese had just laughed. At first he thought Deweese was just laughing at his unintended insult to himself, but that didn't fit because Deweese wasn't a derogatory kind of person at all. Later he saw it was a kind of super-truth laugh. The best students always are flunking. Every good teacher knows that. It was a kind of laughter that destroys tensions produced by impossible situations, and Phaedrus could have used some of it, because at this time he was taking things way too seriously. These enigmatic responses of Deweese gave Phaedrus the idea that Deweese had access to a huge terrain of hidden understanding. Deweese always seemed to be concealing something. He was hiding something from him, and Phaedrus couldn't figure out what it was. Then comes a strong fragment, the day when he discovered Deweese seemed to have the same puzzled feeling about him. A light switch in Deweese's studio didn't work, and he asked Phaedrus if he knew what was wrong with it. He had a slightly embarrassed, slightly puzzled smile on his face, like the smile of an art patron talking to a painter. The patron is embarrassed to reveal how little he knows, but is smiling with the expectation of learning more. Unlike the Sutherlands, who hate technology, Deweese was so far removed from it, he didn't feel it any particular menace. Deweese was actually a technology buff, a patron of the technologies. He didn't understand them, but he knew what he liked, and he always enjoyed learning more. He had the illusion that trouble was in the wire near the bulb, because immediately upon toggling the switch, the light went out. If the trouble had been in the switch, he felt, there would have been a lapse of time before the trouble showed up in the bulb. Phaedrus did not argue with this, but went across the street to the hardware store, bought a switch, and in a few minutes had it installed. It worked immediately, of course, leaving Deweese puzzled and frustrated. "How did you know the trouble was in the switch?" he asked. "Because it worked intermittently when I jiggled the switch." "Well, couldn't it jiggle the wire?" "No." Phaedrus's cocksure attitude angered Deweese, and he started to argue. "How do you know all that?" he said. "It's obvious." "Well, then why didn't I see it?" "You have to have some familiarity." "Then it's not obvious, is it?" Deweese always argued from this strange perspective that made it impossible to answer him. This was the perspective that gave Phaedrus the idea Deweese was concealing something from him. It wasn't until the very end of his stay in Bozeman that he thought he saw, in his own analytic and methodical way, what that perspective was. At the park entrance, we stop and pay a man in a smoky bear hat. He hands us a one-day pass in return. Ahead, I see an elderly tourist take a movie of us, then smile. From under his shorts protrude white legs into street stockings and shoes. His wife, who watches approvingly, has identical legs. I wave to them as we go by, and they wave back. It's a moment that will be preserved on film for years. Phaedrus despised this park without knowing exactly why, because he hadn't discovered it himself, perhaps, but probably not. Something else. The guided tour attitude of the rangers angered him. The Bronx Zoo attitudes of the tourists disgusted him even more. Such a difference from the high country all around. It seemed an enormous museum with exhibits carefully manicured to give the illusion of reality, but nicely chained off so that children would not injure them. People entered the park and became polite and cozy and fakey to each other because the atmosphere of the park made them that way. In the entire time he had lived within 100 miles of it, he had visited it only once or twice. But this is getting out of sequence. There's a span of about 10 years missing. He didn't jump from Immanuel Kant to Bozeman, Montana. During this span of 10 years, he lived in India for a long time, studying Oriental philosophy at Benares Hindu University. As far as I know, he didn't learn any occult secrets there. Nothing much happened at all except exposures. He listened to philosophers, visited religious persons, absorbed and thought, and then absorbed and thought some more, and that was about all. All his letters show is an enormous confusion of contradictions and incongruities and divergences and exceptions to any rule he formulated about the things he observed. He'd entered India an empirical scientist, and he left India an empirical scientist. Not much wiser than he had been when he'd come. However, he'd been exposed to a lot and had acquired a kind of latent image that appeared in conjunction with many other latent images later on. Some of these latencies should be summarized because they become important later on. He became aware that the doctrinal differences among Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism are not anywhere near as important as doctrinal differences among Christianity and Islam and Judaism. Holy wars are not fought over them because verbalized statements about reality are never presumed to be reality itself. In all of the Oriental religions, great value is placed on the Sanskrit doctrine of Tat Tvam Asi, thou art that, which asserts that everything you think you are and everything you think you perceive are undivided. To realize fully this lack of division is to become enlightened. Logic presumes a separation of subject from object. Therefore, logic is not final wisdom. The illusion of separation of subject from object is best removed by the elimination of physical activity, mental activity, and emotional activity. There are many disciplines for this. One of the most important is the Sanskrit dhyana, mispronounced in Chinese as chan, and again mispronounced in Japanese as zen. Phaedrus never got involved in meditation because it made no sense to him. In his entire time in India, sense was always logical consistency, and he couldn't find any honest way to abandon this belief. That, I think, was creditable on his part. But one day in the classroom, the professor of philosophy was blithely expounding on the illusory nature of the world for what seemed the 50th time, and Phaedrus raised his hand and asked coldly, if it was believed that the atomic bombs that had dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were illusory. The professor smiled and said yes. That was the end of the exchange. Within the traditions of Indian philosophy, that answer may have been correct, but for Phaedrus and for anyone else who reads newspapers regularly and is concerned with such things as mass destruction of human beings, that answer was hopelessly inadequate. He left the classroom, left India, and gave up. He returned to his Midwest, picked up a practical degree in journalism, married, lived in Nevada and Mexico, did odd jobs, worked as a journalist, a science writer, and an industrial advertising writer. He fathered 2 children, bought a farm and a riding horse and 2 cars, and was starting to put on middle-aged weight. His pursuit of what has been called the ghost of reason had been given up. That's extremely important to understand. He had given up. Because he'd given up, the surface of life was comfortable for him. He worked reasonably hard, was easy to get along with, and, except for an occasional glimpse of inner emptiness, shown in some short stories he wrote at the time, his days passed quite usually. What started him up here into these mountains isn't certain. His wife seems not to know, but I'd guess it was perhaps some of those inner feelings of failure, and the hope that somehow this might take him back on the track again. He had become much more mature, as if the abandonment of inner goals had caused him somehow to age more quickly. We exit from the park at Gardiner, where not much rain seems to fall because the mountainsides show only grass and sage in the twilight. We decide to stay here for the night. The town is on high banks on either side of a bridge over a river which rushes over smooth and clean boulders. Across the bridge, they've already turned the lights on at the motel while we check in. But even in the artificial light coming from the windows, I can see each cabin has been carefully surrounded by planted flowers. And so I step carefully to avoid them. I notice things about the cabin, too, which I point out to Chris. The windows are all double-hung and sash-weighted. The doors click shut without looseness. All the moldings are perfectly mitered. There's nothing arty about all this. It's just well done, and, something tells me, is all done by one person. When we return to the hotel from the restaurant, an elderly couple are sitting in a small garden outside the office, enjoying the evening breeze. The man confirms that he's made all these cabins himself, and is so pleased it's been noticed that his wife, who sees this, invites us all to sit down. We talk with no need to hurry. This is the oldest entrance to the park. It was used before there were any automobiles. They talk about changes that have taken place over the years, adding a dimension to what we see around us, and it builds to a kind of beautiful thing, this town, this couple, and the years that have gone by here. Sylvia puts her hand on John's arm. I am conscious of the sounds of the river rushing past boulders below, and a fragrance in the night wind. The woman, who knows all fragrances, says it is honeysuckle, and we are quiet for a while, and I become pleasantly drowsy. Chris is almost asleep when we decide to turn in. Chapter 13. John and Sylvia eat their breakfast hotcakes and drink their coffee, still caught up in the mood of last night. But I'm finding it hard to get food down. Today we should arrive at the school, the place where an enormous coalescence of things occurred, and I'm already feeling tense. I remember reading once about an archaeological excavation in the Near East, learning about the archaeologist's feelings when he opened the forgotten tombs for the first time in thousands of years. Now I feel like some archaeologist myself. The sagebrush down the canyon, now toward Livingston, is like sagebrush you'll see all the way from here into Mexico. This morning's sunlight is the same as yesterday's, except warmer and softer, now that we're at a lower altitude again. There is nothing unusual. It's just this archaeological feeling that the calmness of the surroundings conceals things. A haunted place. I really don't want to go there. I'd just as soon turn around and go back. Just tension, I guess. It fits one of the fragments of this memory, in which many mornings the tension was so intense he would throw up everything before he got to his first classroom. He loathed appearing before classrooms of students and talking. It was a complete violation of his whole lone, isolated way of life, and what he experienced was intense stage fright, except that it never showed on him as stage fright, but rather as a terrific intensity about everything he did. Students had told his wife it was just like electricity in the air. The moment he entered the classroom, all eyes turned on him and followed him as he walked to the front of the room. All conversation died to a hush and remained at a hush, even though it was several minutes often, before the class started. Throughout the hour, the eyes never strayed from him. He became much talked about, a controversial figure. The majority of students avoided his sections like the Black Death. They had heard too many stories. The school was what could euphemistically be called a teaching college. At a teaching college, you teach and you teach and you teach with no time for research, no time for contemplation, no time for participation in outside affairs. Just teach and teach and teach until your mind grows dull and your creativity vanishes, and you become an automaton, saying the same dull things over and over to endless waves of innocent students who cannot understand why you are so dull, lose respect, and fan this disrespect out into the community. The reason you teach and you teach and you teach is that this is a very clever way of running a college on the cheap, while giving a false appearance of genuine education. Yet despite this, he called the school by a name that didn't make much sense, in fact sounded a little ludicrous in view of its actual nature. But the name had great meaning to him, and he stuck to it, and he felt, before he left, that he had rammed it into a few minds sufficiently hard to make it stick. He called it a Church of Reason, and much of the puzzlement people had about him could have ended if they'd understood what he meant by this. The state of Montana at this time was undergoing an outbreak of ultra-right-wing politics like that which occurred in Dallas, Texas, just prior to President Kennedy's assassination. A nationally known professor from the University of Montana at Missoula was prohibited from speaking on campus on the grounds that it would stir up trouble. Professors were told that all public statements must be cleared through the college public relations office before they could be made. Academic standards were demolished. The legislature had previously prohibited the school from refusing entry to any student over 21, whether he had a high school diploma or not. Now the legislature had passed a law fining the college $8,000 for every student who failed, virtually in order to pass every student. The newly elected governor was trying to fire the college president for both personal and political reasons. The college president was not only a personal enemy, he was a Democrat, and the governor was no ordinary Republican. His campaign manager doubled as state coordinator for the John Birch Society. This was the same governor who supplied the list of 50 subversives we heard about a few days ago. Now, as part of this vendetta, funds to the college were being cut. The college president had passed on an unusually large part of the cut to the English department, of which Phaedrus was a member, and whose members had been quite vocal on issues of academic freedom. Phaedrus had given up, was exchanging letters with the Northwest Regional Accrediting Association to see if they could help prevent these violations of accreditation requirements. In addition to this private correspondence, he had publicly called for an investigation of the entire school situation. At this point, some students in one of his classes had asked Phaedrus bitterly if his efforts to stop accreditation meant he was trying to prevent them from getting an education. Phaedrus said no. Then one student, apparently a partisan of the governor,